prevent diseases. And it was my dream job. I loved that job. But unfortunately, in the summer of 2000, the biotech company was bought out by another company. And in early August 2000, when I was 37 weeks pregnant with my first child, my whole department of 135 people was laid off one day.
Wow.
So that was a total bummer. And my husband was in a training program at a local university here at the time, so we couldn't leave the area. Luckily, my former employee gave all employees a really generous severance pay of at least 6 months full pay. So that was really good. That I already planned to do like a 12-week maternity leave, and I even had my daughter lined up to go to the daycare center on site at my former employer. And my plans changed a bit, but so I knew that I didn't want to go into academia, and no offense to anyone on the call who's in academia, but I knew it wasn't for me. And St. Louis wasn't really the hotbed of biotech or pharma research. It's actually gotten a lot better. We have a lot more small startup companies here now than we did 20 years ago. But anyway, one of my Northwestern classmates was working as a medical writer at the time, and she encouraged me to check out medical writing. And it did seem like a great fit for me, you know, combining my love of science and writing. So I decided to give freelancing a try, and my first clients were former Monsanto colleagues who now worked at other companies. And so my Northwestern classmate also encouraged me to join AMWA, which I did. And I've attended every AMWA annual conference since 2004, and I've completed several certificates, which were really useful. And so mainly the kind of writing that I do publications and also regulatory writing, and I do a lot of clinical trials results disclosures. So that's my brief story of how I got into freelancing.
Excellent. Thanks, Joanne. And Natalie, could you also provide a brief introduction about how you got into this?
Sure. So, similar to Joanne, I've always enjoyed reading and writing and science. And of course, when I was younger, I didn't combine the two, but I did go into science. My bachelor's is in biochemistry and my PhD is in cell and molecular biology from University of Wisconsin. And I did a postdoc at Yale and a short one at Princeton. And I guess it was like 1999, I was done with my postdoc work and kind of trying to decide what to do next. And I just applied for a job at Nature Biotechnology as an editor because I thought that sounded really fun. And I got the job, and that started like 10, 11 year stint as an editor at Nature. After Nature Biotechnology, after I was there for 2 years, I became an editor at Nature, the weekly journal. And that kind of laid the foundation for, you know, understanding peer review and editing and, you know, all the intricacies of the publishing world. And so I got tired of that after about 10 years and went on to other things, working at a research institute on drug discovery, working at the California Institute of Regenerative Medicine, which is a funding agency. And then at Stanford, I was at Stanford in the role of, can't remember what it was called, but I was basically trying to get grants, write grants and do various things at the behest of the professor I was working for, and which was not very enjoyable for me, to be honest, and laid off because they didn't have money for me anymore. So that was actually a blessing because it prompted me to take the clients that I had been working with as kind of side projects during all these other years. I mean, except when I was at Nature, I didn't have freelance clients because that would have been too much of a conflict of interest. But in my other roles, I was able to do some work here and there for people. And I was contacted a lot by potential clients looking for help with writing and editing. And so I set out on my own as a freelancer at that point, and I started off mainly in publications because that's what I knew best. And then because I had experience at a funding agency, I knew a lot about grants. And so I started writing grants, and I had written grants while I was at Stanford as well. And so I was familiar with the NIH grants and all of that. And so I've been doing that full time for about 5 years. And I am currently working on a combination of regulatory writing, still working on grants, and then I do editing of publications when they come my way. Even, you know, there's a lot cheaper options than me now for editing publications, but I still have clients that, you know, want to, don't mind paying top dollar. And I did, you know, after I decided to kind of branch out, I did some online training and certificates in medical writing, and I did an online course in regulatory that was just like a, you know, massive data dump. It was a lot of information, but I did get a gig as doing steady work for a regulatory writing agency in Sweden. So I'm doing a lot of that kind of writing now. But anyway, that we can talk about more of that stuff later if anybody has any questions about it. But that's it for me.
Excellent. Thanks, Natalie. So I'm going to open the floor to all of the attendees. Feel free to, we'll see how this goes. Since this is our first one, I'm not quite sure the best approach for this, but feel free to just speak out if you have a question, or alternatively, if you'd like to just type the message in the chat function, if you are online, that's fine too. So does anyone have any particular questions for our panelists?
Hi, this is Raisa. I can start with like a general question for
sure.
All of our panelists, I guess. So all of you seem to be doing different kinds of writing. And I was just curious if, you know, what your opinion is on doing different kinds versus just like buckling down on one, say like grant writing or publications, or trying to separate academic writing versus regulatory writing, and what your take is on that.
Whoever wants to answer it, feel free.
Well, I can start. Yeah, I do quite a bit of different writing. And in terms of separating academic and industry, I don't really see why you would want to do that, because that's just narrowing your client base. And it's true that, like, industry, you know, there's certain things you need to know about working with an industry client, and the confidentiality and managing documents in a secure way. But, you know, that should be done for academics as well. So I don't really personally see a huge difference, and I wouldn't recommend, you know, I would discouraging any particular type of client. In terms of working on all the different types of projects, the main thing is people usually want to see that you have some experience in a particular area. So the risk of doing too many different things is that you don't appear to have a strong expertise in what they want. But other than just getting, you know, spreading yourself thin so that you maybe haven't done 15 NIH grants and, you know, you've only done two. I don't see any reason not to have a broad scope. And, you know, also certain types of writing pay more than others. And so that's why, like, regulatory writing for industry clients, you know, I get paid a lot more than doing something for an academic client, like, you know, editing an abstract. So I'm always, you know, trying to encourage the business that's going to make my time pay off the most. So that's certainly something to think about when you're thinking about which projects to accept.
Does anyone else have a response they want to add?
Go ahead, Lisa.
I was just going to say, I think you have to have some kind of specialty that you can advertise to people. You can't say, well, I'll just do anything, because people don't know what to call you for. But we've especially learned, like with a local tech writers group, everybody's kind of got their own little niche that you, oh, you want this? Well, that's the kind of thing Betsy does. So you need to go talk to her, you know, engineering manuals, that would be her. But it doesn't, it could, so it could be, you know, a kind of client or a kind of document or a timeline or a subject area. But just as long as you've got, you know, some kind of focus, I think that could be whatever.
This is Joanne. I'll follow up on Lisa and say it'd be a good idea to pick some kind of writing that you like. Maybe you really like writing grants or journal articles or some other kind of writing.
Okay, so you would then recommend to pick something that you like, but then if some, you know, other kind of work comes your way, not to, of course, not to turn it down, but then also try to build your skills in that direction?
Yes, definitely.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there any other questions?
I had a question. I'm Crystal Austin. I wanted to know what the resources were for getting online training in regulatory writing.
Well, this is Natalie. San Diego State University has a regulatory writing program. They have a master's and then they offer a certificate, and you can just take ad hoc classes, you know, when you have time if you don't want to do a certificate or a master's. And I thought they're pretty good. I also went to RAP and they have some resources, but I took one of their regulatory courses, and I don't know if it specifically focused on writing. It might have been more of a broad overview, and I just found it was a lot of material to absorb in a short time. And you know, I guess it's good to get some kind of familiarity with terminology, but it's if you're not really working in the area, it's going to be difficult to absorb all of that. But there's other regulatory writing programs around, but the San Diego State is the one I use.
Natalie, to follow up on that, do you recommend some type of education in regulatory writing if people are interested in getting into that?
Yeah, I think it's a hard area to just walk into without any experience whatsoever. So yeah, I definitely do recommend just at least taking one course. And you know, if you really see if you like it and you think it's what you want to do, then seeing if it makes sense to get a master's or at least a certificate in it, so you at least have that credential.
Staying on the education spotlight, I just want to kind of stay in this area since a question was asked. For the panelists, have you taken any other education courses, whether they're from AMWA or anyone else, and do you recommend them? Do you find that they were beneficial?
So this is Joanne. I did a long time ago, AMWA had what they called a core curriculum certificate, and they also had an advanced certificate, and I did both. I completed both of those, and I thought they were really good. I know now they have something called essential skills, which some of it can be done on your own, which is cool, but the in-person workshops at the annual conference are very good.
Yeah, I would say I've attended lots of workshops and webinars. I've never done a specific course. Although I did recall after I'd been doing this for a long time, I remembered one of my undergrad English professors trying to convince me to be an English major because she thought I was a really good writer. So, and I remember looking at her and telling her, well, I mean, I'm not going to do that. You can't make a living as a writer. So I think the course, if you know, if you need the courses, if you're going to learn something that you don't know, depending on what your educational background and how extensive your network is, they can be good just, you know, for credibility. But I would be cautious about, you know, spending a whole lot of money on something that, you know, may or may not actually provide a whole lot of value.
Okay, great. Just some quick business information ahead of time. I've been muting people who are not muted just to try to alleviate any sort of static or background noise. So if you want to speak, just please try to unmute yourself at that time. Moving on, a couple people posted some questions in the group chat, so I'm going to address those. Amy asked, any advice on how to avoid rabbit holes? For example, she's been writing CME cases outside of her area expertise, and she likely spends many more hours on it than necessary, doing background reading to make sure she has enough understanding to write the case. The same goes for fact-checking and research. How do you know when you are done? Would anyone like to address that?
Well, I think this is Natalie. It's a good idea to have an idea of the amount of time that the client expects you to work on it before you begin. And if, you know, that should give you a guideline. Now, sometimes they don't always have realistic expectations. So, you know, they might err on the side, or they may err on the side of not projecting enough time that you really need. But then a lot of us, I mean, I'm very much this way. I could just spend, you know, days on something that really doesn't take that much time, just tinkering with it. And you definitely don't want to start going down that path. So I would say start off by getting an estimate from the client. And then you should, you know, if you get to a point where it's in good shape, but there's still some things you need to do to polish it, you know, you could talk to the client about whether you could, you know, have additional time to do whatever done necessarily be essential. Or if you don't have that kind of rapport with the client, you know, you do want everything to be perfect, but perfection can take a long time. You could just, that's where it gets a little tricky. Maybe one of the other panelists has a way of avoiding going down the rabbit hole.
Well, okay, something that I've been successful with projects where it's, you know, research on a topic and then write an article, is actually split it into two projects. So the research is its own project. It's got its own end and timeline and budget. And you turn over the research, well, this is what I found. This article, you know, might not make sense to actually do, but then the actual writing of the article is a second separate project. So it lets you renegotiate in the middle. If you find out, oh, there's, you know, not enough information on this topic, or, oh my gosh, there's, you know, way more on this topic. So sometimes that can help. But yeah, I agree. It's usually we're doing this because we're, you know, curious people who are interested in lots of different things, and it's hard not to get sucked into, oh, this, oh, but that.
Any other points from the panelists? I would just add from my experience as well, yes, it's very easy to go down that rabbit hole. And I oftentimes have to tell myself that it's not necessary to be an expert on whatever I am writing about. though it's, you know, like you said, Joanne, with our nature, it's really hard to keep that in mind throughout the process.
Well, and also theoretically, the client is the expert on the subject, so I always send drafts back, and it's, you know, this is the best that I could do with the information that I had, but you're the expert. You need to read this and make sure it's all perfect.
Right. All right, moving on. Susan has a question. She's asking, what do you think about the AMWA MWC program? Now I'm not, oh, is that the certificate program, I'm assuming? Anyone have any response about that?
I'm not familiar with it. I think that's the exam, the certification exam you could take.
Okay. Have any of our panelists done the certification?
And I have not.
I have not. My impression is that it's a pretty new thing. So, I mean, not to discourage anybody, but given it is, the reason I bring this up is I asked what their past fail rate was to one of the people who work for AMWA on that, and they said, well, that it was new and they didn't really know, or he wasn't going to disclose it or whatever. So that gave me the impression, I mean, if they don't know what their pass rate is, it struck me as kind of a new thing. So that's really all I know.
What about our attendees? Have any of you taken this certification? And if so, what did you think about it? I'm assuming that's a no. So sorry, Susan, that we don't have much to offer in regards to that. Like they said, I think it really is a new program. So I guess the jury is out on the value of that at this point in time. She also asked, how do you best promote your PhD or medical background, especially if it is broad-based and or more organic in nature than pure molecular biology in focus? So can any of the panelists answer that? How do you promote your business?
I would say most of
Natalie. Oh,
go ahead, Natalie.
Okay. My PhD is in cell and molecular biology, so I can't speak to promoting something that's at kind of at a different level of scale. But in terms of promoting the fact that I have a PhD and my business in general, the first thing you should do is create a website, and there you can give your background, your research background. You know, they'll probably want to know your familiarity with research, and part of that your PhD, or if it's medical, then obviously that. I guess marketing is maybe a separate question that we could address separately so we don't get sidetracked. But if you want to put PhD in your signature line and mention it in your LinkedIn, your LinkedIn profile, and on your website, that should, I would think, be sufficient for them to get the message that you have a PhD or an MD.
This is Joanne. I also have a list of topics and therapeutic areas on my LinkedIn and my website, all the different ones, and I update it regularly whenever I work on a new area.
So since we're kind of going down this path, does anyone want to add anything additional in regards to marketing? Do you all have a website and LinkedIn account?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Everyone does?
Yes.
Okay.
If you're talking,
panelists. Yeah.
Yes, panelists, sorry. And how do you find that you get most of your clients? Is it from word of mouth, your website, LinkedIn, the free AMWA freelance directory?
As I said, I've been doing this for 28 years, and every job except one has been word of mouth. Somebody that I worked with or somebody who knew somebody that I worked with said, hey, you know, Lisa could help you with this. So it really is having a good reputation and letting people know that this is what you do for a living.
That's the same with Natalie. I have tried using LinkedIn as a marketing tool, and I just can't. I mean, people do contact me through LinkedIn. I would say that it's really important to have a great LinkedIn site that emphasizes the type of jobs that you want and your experience in that area. But there are ways of using LinkedIn to reach out to people and do marketing, but I have never done that. It seems to me it takes some time to figure out how to do it. And I get kind of annoyed when people contact me with these marketing emails through LinkedIn where it has nothing to do with me and why would I be interested? And so I don't want to do the same thing. There are companies that will sell you mailing lists of like decision makers at pharmaceutical companies and so on. And they contact me and they want quite a bit of money for those mailing lists. So I've never done that either, but I'm always really busy just from word of mouth.
And I will say I've also been contacted by many recruiters on LinkedIn, but it's never been an opportunity that I was actually interested in. It's usually, you know, software manual for household devices or something.
I've gotten work from the AMWA freelance directory and from LinkedIn, maybe five or six jobs where people found me on LinkedIn and contacted me. I those recruiter things are very annoying, I agree. but I don't do any marketing on LinkedIn. I mainly use LinkedIn as an electronic Rolodex and you know, connecting with people I meet or work for or used to be in the same company with or school. I find it's good for it's like a collection of all your connections in one place. And then word of mouth is probably.
Yeah, I was going to say you have to have a good profile on LinkedIn because potential clients will vet you there a lot of times before they contact you. But that's more passive marketing, I think, than active.
Right.
To follow up on this in regards to the website, Susan asked, what approach did you use to set up your website? Are you WordPress reliant only, or do you outsource this? And do you rely on Google Analytics? So how did you create your website? Did you create it yourselves, or did you outsource it?
I used an awesome graphic designer. And
yeah,
she set it up in Wix, W-I-X, Wix. And it's very easy to edit. I can easily edit. And, you know, like I said, I can add new content very easily. And I have a specific email specific to my business through Wix. It's G Suite. It's basically a Gmail that has my domain. So that's what I did.
Anyone else?
I created my website using HTML back before there was WordPress or WYSIWYG editors. So, and it probably shows on the site. I maintain it myself. So like I said, it's basically, it's a lot of information. It's not as pretty as it could be, but it's functional.
Natalie?
I know a lot of people use WordPress and I've done some work on that type of software to do websites and it is fairly simple, but the web designers
tend to know about things like, you know, if you're going, how to make your website show up on searches and things that become a little bit more nuanced. So it would cost like maybe $500. I used somebody in South America that was, you know, very, very good. And I thought that was a reasonable amount of money and he did a great job. So yeah, that's how I did it.
Great. Just to add to this discussion, I also used Wix to create my website. However, I created it on my own. So that is another option. It is a very easy site to use and it gives you a lot of templates that you can use to create the website. Susan is also asking, let's see, how do you develop a good reputation? Suppose you perform for a vendor, but you don't hit it off with them. What would you suggest? Any response to that?
Well, this is Natalie. I mean, I guess if you can get some feedback on what wasn't, you know, optimal, if you don't know already, so then you can improve if it has something to do with your performance or your performance or whatever the issue was, I would suggest trying to have that conversation if it's appropriate, of course. And then, you know, that there are going to be those situations, either because of personal, just, you know, some people have different styles that mesh or they don't mesh. And so there can be that component. And, you know, I have clients that are, you know, it's been great and they love me. And then there's clients where, you know, it didn't go as well. And that's natural, but hopefully you're going to have, you know, much more in the positive category or you need to rethink how you're doing things. And then, you know, when they do have a positive experience, that's where the word of mouth starts to come in. And that's where you can really get a lot of, you know, get your company rolling. So yeah, without knowing exactly not hitting it off means, that's sort of a general answer.
Okay. Any other questions you'd like to address to the panelists? Susan.
Maybe something.
Go ahead, please.
This is Crystal. Maybe, something you wish you would have known when you were starting your business?
Anyone from our panelists? Things that you wish you knew way back when you first started?
I wish I knew that it was hard to break into regulatory writing without having, like previously worked at a company.
I think what I would say is I wish I had known the importance of networking and, you know, maintaining relationships with your peers and, you know, paying it forward, you know, trying to, you know, do nice things and help other people so that they remember you positively.
Anyone else?
Sorry, I was on mute. Natalie. I guess I wish that I had, when I started my freelance business, I had a lot of experience with scientific publications from my work at Nature, but that's a very kind of narrow kind of writing. And I wish I had taken a course that kind of broadened my ability to work with different types of documents and just really kind of the mechanics of writing and working with Word and what the expectations are for, you know,
documents that are meant to be submitted to, say, a regulatory agency that I could have gotten had I done a class sooner. Some experience you have to kind of learn on the job, but that was one area where once I took the course, I was like, wow, this really helped me a lot.
Great. Raisa had a question for the panelists. How do you deal with pricing? Do you charge project-based or hourly? And how do you deal with clients who don't want to pay fairly? Anyone?
I charge hourly, and in the past, I've used the tools like the AMLA salary survey to, justify the rates that I charge. I can say, this is what the going rate is.
I will say I do most things hourly. I do a couple things by the project, but those are more historical than anything else. And yeah, like Joanne, I use the AMWIS salary survey and other things to show, this is the going market rate for the kind of work you're asking me to do.
This is Natalie. I do both. I charge different prices for different projects, different types of writing or editing. And I also charge differently depending on what kind of client it is. And it's really kind of hard. I mean, you can look at the AMWA salary survey. It gives you an indication. But that's going to depend on factors like, are you living in, the San Francisco Bay Area or in Des Moines, Iowa? I've lived in both, and you need to charge a lot more if you're living in San Francisco. And also, if you don't have much experience, then, you would probably go on the lower side. But you don't want them to think you're charging a way too little because you don't know what you're doing. So you kind of want to stay in a credible range. I had something else I wanted to add to that. Oh, and clients that don't want to pay fairly. Well, I mean, you just don't take the job. If you've already done it and you're having trouble getting them to pay, it's important to have a contract and everything clearly spelled out before you begin a project so that you don't have them change midstream and not want to pay you what you expect.
I would also advise against taking initial jobs at a really low rate, just to get experience, and then thinking you're going to raise your rates dramatically later on. That usually doesn't work because you set the expectation that you're, at a certain price, and it's really hard to say, oh, okay, well, now I'm worth twice that much.
Just as a follow-up to the pricing question, so when you charge hourly, do you have to estimate or give your client an estimate of how long it's going to take up front, and what happens if it, you realize it's taking longer or there's just too much research to do and things like that?
They always are going to want an estimate up front, and so you can give them that estimate as long as you keep them informed of, hey, I'm getting close to it. Should we cut back? Is it okay if I go over? A lot of times in my contracts, I'll also put it not to exceed. So I think this project is going to take 100 hours, but I will not put in more than 120 without, an additional addendum or something.
Okay.
To add to the pricing discussion, how often do you, as the panelists, increase your rates?
Well, if I have a new client, then there's no problem increasing my rate. But increasing a rate on an existing client they take it really personally for some reason. So I try not to do it very often, but like I've had this one client for about 10 years, and I've only increased the price once with him, but I'm already asking it. I asked him, for a decent price from the beginning. So it's not like I feel like I'm being way underpaid with him. But yeah, I would try to do it sparingly because it doesn't engender good feelings. But, obviously you do need to kind of look at the, price of cost of living increases. And if you feel like your experience is so vastly much better and you're way more efficient and do things faster, you could justify it that way.
I just raised my rates on a client that I've had for about 2 years. I said, hey, I've been working for you for 2 years. I'm going to raise my rates a little bit. And he wrote back and said, great, you deserve it. And I went, oh, darn, I should ask for more.
Well, they don't always react that way.
No, they don't. But that was nice to hear. So it does happen sometimes.
Just to add, this is Rebecca. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to start talking about charging per project. So if you want to finish this.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I was just going to add from my experience, I just raised my rate this past year and I had one client who I had to kind of fight with about it and another client that was totally willing to do it, no questions asked. So it totally depends on the client, I've realized. So next topic, go ahead. Project-based?
Yeah, I do some projects that way, and they're generally grants where it's, very much a set number of pages. I kind of know what's involved and I can pretty accurately predict the amount of time it's going to take, although it's always going to vary depending on what they give me to work with. But I've found with some clients, they'll say, can you work on this grant? And then I'll book like a whole month to work on it. And then they'll back out and say, oh no, we can't do it right now. We're going to have to delay it. And then I'm with a whole month where I don't have work and I have to scramble. So I've started asking for like a third of the amount, say it's $15,000. I'll ask them to pay $5,000 upfront and it's non-refundable. And that helps. And so I've still had clients back out, but, because they had to get an IND approved and it didn't happen. And, but for me, I was still stuck in the hole without any work for that month. So that's something that you could think about doing. I mean, I feel a little mean in a way, but you do have to protect yourself from these uncertainties that arise, with your clients not knowing exactly what they're going to do. And then in terms of pricing, I think that doing it per project makes sense because it's rewarding efficiency. If you're working per hour and you're not working efficiently, you're benefiting at the expense of the client. So that doesn't completely make sense, which is an argument for doing this per project pricing. But, if you're doing something, everybody has their comfort level with doing it one way or another, but that's just sort of the background on my experience.
Following up with a second question from Raisa, she's asking, do you have general insurance to protect your business?
I have $1 million per incident liability insurance with an aggregate of $3 million. So if I make a mistake and I get sued by a client, that would pay up to $1 million in damages. Of course, in my contract, I say the client is responsible for the accuracy and so on, but, you know, it could still happen that you could have a lawsuit because of perceived negligence or something like that, or, you know, losing your computer with all their files on it, or, you know, something terrible could happen. So it's only like, I think it was like $300 a year. So for the peace of mind, I think it's worth it.
Anyone else? All right. And then she's also asking about tips for time management. How do you manage your time? Any of our panelists, how do you manage your time?
Not as well as I'd like to.
I know. I have lots of
avoiding getting sucked down into those rabbit holes. I find it works well for me when I know I'm on the clock for a client. I tend to be more efficient. So, or if I'm just going to do, you know, one little thing or another little thing, I tend to waste a lot of time and go off. But if I can do things on the clock, I work better.
Yeah, I think I have a lot of different clients that I work with at the same time sometimes, and so I have software that tracks my time for each project. Mm-hmm. It's called Time Camp, but I'm sure there's a million of those products. But if I'm going to go to the trouble of logging into Time Camp, I want to have, you know, I don't want to just do one little thing here and one little thing here and one little thing here. So I sort of group for the clients. I make a list as I'm going about my business and thinking about what to do, and then I try to do it all at once. Otherwise, I mean, I find it's a real problem that I feel like I've worked a 12-hour day, and then when I look at my billable hours, it's like 6, and I don't know why it is, but so I'm always trying to increase my efficiency so that when I'm working, I'm getting paid, and when I'm not working, I'm not getting paid, and, you know, that I keep very good records of that.
Back to the liability insurance, Susan asked, what carrier are you using for your professional liability insurance?
I will look it up. So just give me a minute and I'll do that and you can go on to another.
Okay. Any other questions from our attendees? From the business side of things, do you organize your company as a sole proprietor, an LLC, or a corporation?
This is Joanne. I'm a sole proprietor.
Okay.
I was a sole proprietor for a long time. I'm now an LLC.
I'm a sole proprietor. I was an LLC, and then my accountant convinced me to switch back to sole proprietor.
Okay, great. Any other questions for our panelists?
Oh, this is Natalie. The name of my liability insurance is CM&F Group.
Susan, did you get that? Can you repeat that again?
C as in Charlie, M as in Mary, and F as in Frank Group.
Great. Excellent. Thank you. Okay, we only have a couple minutes left. Any other questions out there that I may have missed?
Well, this is Natalie. I just wanted to say generally, if you want to switch, I mean, when someone asks, like, what would you do differently, or what do you wish you knew? And one thing I didn't have when I started solely doing freelance work was a big cushion of savings. So, you know, I had some months where I was, you know, really stressed out about money. I would suggest if you're going to go from a regular job where you're getting a salary to freelancing where it's unpredictable, that you have a pretty good amount of savings to get you through the beginning where you may not have as many clients. And even, you know, even if you've been doing it a long time, there may be some times that for whatever reason, you know, one week you may have 10 people knocking on your door and another week, nobody. So it's always good to have savings, when you're working on your own.
And I think that's a good point in there, that it's always either feast or famine.
Thanks for bringing that up. That is definitely true. So to follow up on that, how do you manage that? How many clients do you try to keep on a regular basis? How often are you willing to take new clients on in order to prevent that feast or famine?
Well, it's always a juggling act, and you, I guess I'd rather, be transparent and say, this is my situation. I have a little bit of time. I can work on this, so it may take longer. And often they're fine with that. And if they have a really pressing deadline and it needs to be done really quickly, and I have another job, that I would rather not imperil the client getting their thing done in time by taking on that work. So you just have to kind of see where the client is with their deadlines.
Yeah, some deadlines are more movable than others. I also always have lots of volunteer work that I can use to fill in downtime. So you take non-time sensitive stuff and use it to fill in the holes.
And I also feel like once you get going freelancing, you'll figure out kind of how many projects you can juggle at a time.
Great. Well, we're almost to our 1 o'clock cutoff time. Are there any other questions that you'd like to address to our panelists? All right. Well, with that, I want to thank. Please jump in, please.
Oh, I just wanted to say I don't have any other questions, but this is Crystal, and thank you for letting me join in, even though I'm not an AMWA member yet, but I will be soon.
Great. Excellent. Good luck to you.
Thanks.
Well, thank you to our panelists. I appreciate your time and willingness to participate in this, and I hope that all of our attendees were able to get some useful information out of this. If you ever get a chance, I'd appreciate some feedback on this. If you think that this was helpful and you'd like to see more of these webinars again in the future, please just shoot me an email. Also, if you have any ideas for future webinars, please let me know that as well. And with that, we will close the meeting. Thank you all again, and have a great rest of your afternoon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.